Welcome to JFK Lancer Conversations, an online interview program featuring discussions with prominent authors, historical researchers, and notable personalities associated with the study of President Kennedy's assassination.
Welcome to Conversations. My name is Alan Dale. On November 29, 1963, President Johnson announced the creation of the President's Commission on the Assassination of President Kennedy, which would forever be known as the Warren Commission. Its final report, presented to the President on September 24, 1964, and made public 3 days later, declared that Lee Harvey Oswald had acted alone in the attack which resulted in the death of President Kennedy and the wounding of Texas Governor John Connally, and that Jack Ruby had acted alone in murdering Oswald. Our topic today is criticism. Winston Churchill said, "Criticism may not be agreeable, but it is necessary. It fulfills the same function as pain in the human body. It calls attention to an unhealthy state of things." Warren Commission member and future President Gerald Ford described their report by claiming, "The monumental record of the President's Commission will stand like a Gibraltar of factual literature through the ages to come." 30 years later, after an ocean of dissent and criticism of the official findings, Norman Mailer compared the commission's work to a dead whale decomposing on a beach. The late Harold Weisberg quoted Warren Commission member Senator Richard Russell as saying very simply, "We have not been told the truth about Oswald." In 1998, in a chapter titled "The Problem of Secrecy and the Solution of the JFK Act," the Assassination Records Review Board, which was created to collect and review the documents relating to the assassination, pointed out in its final report, "Doubts about the Warren Commission's findings were not restricted to ordinary Americans. Well before 1978, President Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and four of the seven members of the Warren Commission all articulated, if sometimes off the record, some level of skepticism about the Commission's basic findings. And today, in the year 2014, a majority of Americans share that skepticism." Our guest is one of the world's leading authorities on the Warren Commission, its methods and practices. His meticulous research, published in a new edition of his book, Breach of Trust, How the Warren Commission Failed the Nation and Why, is an essential resource for all who are invested in seeking to know the truth about how the government of the United States responded to the assassination of President Kennedy. It's an honor for me to introduce Professor Gerald D. McKnight. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Professor, would it be an apt restatement of the name of the President's Commission if we referred to the Prejudiced Commission on the Assassination on President Kennedy?
We certainly could get away with that without much fault finding if people knew a little bit of what went on there. Yes, it was from the very beginning. The commission, we could just make one point right here. The commission presumably is going to produce this report based largely and almost exclusively on the FBI commission document one, and going ahead in that fashion. One major, almost astonishing fact is that the Warren Commission never bothered to bring under its attention, or at least in any published way, the fact that in part of one of the things that it looked at in terms of documentation was JFK's death certificate. So here we have the commission that is supposed to write the report based on largely, almost exclusively, on the FBI investigation, and they cannot find the time or the interest or the reason or the rationale for looking at JFK's death certificate, which understandably in the long run is going to be a problem, because the death certificate written by Dr. Berkeley before the politics of this issue entered into this business. What the Berkeley death certificate pointed out was particularly, which is key here, that the wound in Kennedy's back was at the third thoracic vertebrae. Well, this is before politics entered into the discussion here, And what that meant, the Warren Commission is going to talk about three shots, two shots hit, one shot misses. But the point, the basic point here, I'll get off this right now, is that there is a key piece of evidence, and I don't care where you would stand on this issue, a key piece of evidence that the Warren Commission, and this is the commission that was contracted to write the report, never bothered to collect, never bothered to look at. I mean, that in itself is, you know, one would have to say it provokes a puzzling attitude about how things were, yeah, you know, how things were going. I thought maybe I'd throw that in here now, just as an indication of how how this whole investigation was constructed. And I would add to that, I mean, if I'm talking about the commission, I also would talk about the FBI. The FBI turns out its report, Commission Document 1, that report is out and into the hands of the commission in December. The FBI, in making its report, never bothered to collect from the Secret Service the Bethesda Naval Hospital report on the Kennedy autopsy. Mm-hmm. They just said we don't need it right now. That report was ready. The Secret Service had it, offered it to the FBI. The FBI, Alex Rosen, who was about the third man in the power chain within the FBI, heard from Hoover, I guess, and he said we don't really need that now to write our report. And of course they wrote the report, and we could talk about it. But the other thing is that before the report ever became public, they had leaked the conclusions of the report to press people all
right
over the country.
Very deliberate.
And so, oh, absolutely. And the FBI was quite good at that because they did have their own favorite reporters.
Are we referring to December of 63?
For the
FBI Commission Document 1.
Yes.
And that's a 39-page document, am I correct? Mm-hmm. 39 pages.
Yes. Yep.
And among those 39 pages, how many words are devoted to an actual description of the assassination? You said it's 60 words.
Very little. very little. I mean, we're talking about economy here, of language. That was CD one, and right, there's CD one. I think if you were honest with yourself, if you were to read CD one, which is supposed to be, as Katzenbach said when he looked at it or when he received it, he wrote back to the FBI and he called this report sensational.
Wow.
Katzenbach plays a huge role here.
Attorney General probably stepping up with much more detail responsibilities because of
absolutely
Robert Kennedy's
sure
grief.
Bobby Kennedy is trying to hold the family together. He's taking it over in that sense. I mean, he really is. He's the Attorney General. I mean, de facto Attorney General in this particular situation, and took tremendous. He was not hesitant about moving in and taking over responsibility. Mm-hmm. I think within three, four days after the assassination, he was already putting together a tentative outline of what the report should look like. So, I mean, there was no grass growing under Katzenbach's feet in this situation. And, you know, rubbed me the wrong way in a way, is that Katzenbach was part of the Kennedy team, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy was in his own way a rather remarkable guy. He was World War II. He was Air Force. He was shot down. He was a German POW. He escaped. He got back to the United States. He continued his service in the Air Force. I mean, you know, the guy was remarkable, and then he became part of the Kennedy family. I mean, he was up at Hyannisport playing those great
Bobby's kids
football
referred to
games.
Him as Uncle Nick, yeah. And
Uncle
he
Nick,
was the
yes
administration's point man confronting George Wallace. So
yes,
he was an extraordinary person. But we focus on the letter, his letter. Was it to Bill Moyers? Have I forgotten?
Yes. Yeah. It was to Bill Moyers.
Well, tell me about
letter.
That letter.
the chronology quickly in terms of this situation is that on the 22nd, of course, we have Kennedy being shot. The 23rd of November, Oswald, of course, is in custody, and on the 23rd, there paraffin tests were run on Oswald on probably late in the evening of the 22nd. 23rd, the results came back from the paraffin test, and the results of the paraffin test showed that he had paraffin positive, which is, you know, the test of whether he fired a weapon or not.
Yep.
His hands were positive, his cheeks were negative,
mm-hmm.
which meant that, particularly in terms of the weapon we're talking about, the Mannlicher-Carcano CD, the Mannlicher-Carcano, which the FBI asserted that he used in this situation,
mm-hmm.
that Mannlicher-Carcano, when it was turned over to the FBI. FBI agents to test it, the condition of that weapon, you probably know that, the condition of the weapon was so horrendous that these FBI guys said, we refuse to use this weapon until we clean it up, we strengthen, we shim the scope, we clean the weapon out, because if we use it now, it's going to blow up in our faces.
Yeah.
I mean, they spent a good deal of hardware and a good deal of time,
mm-hmm.
in getting that weapon into a condition where one could look at it and say, yes, okay.
And am I correct, there was also a succession of ballistics or a succession of shooting tests where all, without exception, all of the tests indicated an enormous cloud, or at least a significant and measurable cloud of the materials that would be measurable,
mm-hmm.
in a paraffin test.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And I'll say something about that later on, a year later, something about that particular aspect of,
mm-hmm.
the situation. The point is, that on the 23rd, I think most readers who know something about this certainly know a little bit about the chronology, but for those who don't, on the 23rd, Hoover was preparing to go with Tolson up to Baltimore to play the Ponies. They did that on weekends.
That's right. Yeah.
But before he left, he had a telephone call with Lyndon, with Johnson, and in that telephone call, what he said to Johnson was, and this is what he was saying, because by that time, by Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, it was 10, something like that, 10:30, the results, he was able to get the results of the paraffin test. And, of course, the results of the paraffin test simply demonstrated that Oswald didn't shoot anybody. And so he had to say, as he had to say to Johnson, that the case against Oswald is, I think his quote was, not very, very strong. And that was based on forensic evidence. I mean, there we have this brick wall, forensic evidence brick wall. Oswald did not use that rifle to shoot anybody.
It's very interesting what a difference a day can make, because by the evening the next day,
next day Oswald is gone, and that's it. There will be no trial. There'll be no investigation. There'll be no back and forth over the evidence.
But there will be an official truth. There will be an
mm-hmm.
official truth that early on. I want to go
yes.
back to just one moment. You,
sure.
your new version, or new edition, rather, of Breach of Trust, which
mm-hmm.
is available
yep.
right now, includes something that I find truly remarkable, referring to Admiral Berkeley, who was...
Mm-hmm.
We have no reason to question his loyalty to President Kennedy. He was President Kennedy's physician.
Yes.
He participated in some capacity as a liaison between Robert Kennedy and the theater in which an autopsy on President Kennedy was being performed.
Mm-hmm.
And
he was there.
He
yes.
was there. And he was there, and he was aware of what was taking place.
Mm-hmm.
Something that drew my attention from your preface to the paperback edition, and if I can quote it, it says, in 1967, Admiral Berkeley agreed to take part in an oral history interview for the John
mm-hmm.
F. Kennedy Library. When asked whether he agreed with the Warren Report's description of the shooting, Berkeley's terse response was, I would not care to be quoted on that.
Yeah.
Now, isn't that a powerful statement?
Yeah. Yeah. He was embattled, and I don't know whether Johnson, called him in and gave him the Johnson treatment. In other words, yeah.
He promoted him for one thing. Johnson kept him the fold, you know.
He was boosted up from either rear to vice or vice to rear.
Vice Admiral, and, I think. Yeah, Vice Admiral.
What was it?
He became Vice Admiral.
Vice Admiral, and he is only the second presidential physician who was of that particular status.
Yeah, the other
who was also not only the president physician, but he was promoted up to Vice Admiral.
Yeah.
I don't know Berkeley clearly, and I don't know what kind of person he was. I think he was a person of some substance.
Sure.
Before we forget it, here's Berkeley. He saw the dead body. He saw the medical heroics at Parkland Memorial Hospital when they were working on the president, and all they could do was relieve him somewhat of his breathing in terms of a tracheotomy. Over the bullet hole in his neck, a frontal bullet wound, a bullet from the front, and they were working on that. Well, he saw that. He had to know that, and he's also the one who wrote the death certificate. And the death certificate has Kennedy's non-fatal back wound at third thoracic vertebrae, which from a shot from the rear on a downward trajectory at third thoracic vertebrae is not going to exit the neck.
Shallow wound, as far as we can tell, right? A shallow wound that the attending autopsist, the physician, was able to feel the end of the wound with his pinky?
Yes, that was it. When you get right down to basic and irreducible facts or a difference here, what we have with the FBI, we have the fact that there were three shots, two of them hit Kennedy.
And one hit Governor Conway.
A separate hit Governor Conway.
So three shots, three hits. That's the FBI's report as of December.
That's the FBI. And, right. And then for your listeners and all, we could just simply say, when you look at the FBI report. When you look at the Warren Commission, we have three shots, two hits, one miss.
And that's because of the entrance of James Tague,
the FBI refused. The FBI refused to even acknowledge the fact that this man walked.
You've included some marginalia that apparently Hoover was famous for writing in the margins of things, and he didn't buy that at all. So we have no resolution. We have no resolution in terms of the irreconcilable distinction, a conflict between the FBI and the Warren Commission's conclusion. How many people who believe there was Lee Harvey Oswald in an unaffiliated act, how many people acknowledge that fact, that the FBI and the Warren Commission are at irreconcilable differences?
Yeah. Well, in 67, there was an effort. I'm trying to think of a lawyer who had close contact with Hoover, who interceded here and it was 1967. I'm trying to think of the lawyer's name. He was a Wheeler dealer, an insider, and he knew everybody, and he knew Hoover. And he came to Hoover and said, "Is there anything you can do in a way to elucidate on the position of the physicians here, and maybe try to square the circle in terms of what they said and what you said?"
And how did Hoover respond?
And Hoover said, "I don't think so." I don't think so. He did not go for the bait. I wonder if the bait really wasn't this lawyer who was being an intermediary for President Johnson.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Who probably in 67 was a little bit maybe, himself. I mean, considering the fact that he plays a major role. As he is a part of the grand architect of this thing in Dallas. I think will come out one day that Lyndon Johnson was a leading figure in the Kennedy assassination.
I
regard him anyway. I may sound crazy, but I regard him as an American Caligula.
Yeah.
The most dangerous man who ever occupied the presidency of the United States.
Yeah.
And a man who was not well-wrapped mentally.
Well, there's and, a wonderful book written by a physician who was a close friend of Hubert Humphrey's called Hubert. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the book in a number of decades, but I remember reading it when it came out. And it was one of the most, I thought, revealing depictions of Hubert Humphrey's perspective about the irrationalities, unbelievable, powerful mood swings, the incredible handle with care that was required in the dealings in the inner circle around Lyndon Johnson. I just found I just found this from your book, Breach of Trust. In October of 1966, President Johnson called on an old friend, Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas, to approach the FBI director about undertaking a series of lengthy articles or a book.
That was it. That's what I was referring to.
Concerning the captioned
to.
Matter. And the request
was it 66? Okay, 66, I thought it was 67.
Late 66.
Abe Fortas.
And so they approach Clyde Tolson, and Tolson parades out reasons why the director could never oblige any such a request. Mm-hmm. This is amazing to me, because really the request clearly is indeed coming from Johnson, who wants some kind of bow put on this, something to make it tidier. And Fortas then advanced a more modest request: would the director consider writing one brief article restricted, this is a quote, restricted solely to the controversy raised by critics with respect to the differences as shown in the autopsy between FBI reports and the final conclusion of the Warren Commission. Hoover declined Fortas' request.
Right. It's like somebody leaving a turd on the dining room table, isn't it? I mean, really, you know, in terms of something you, I mean, if you're paying any attention at all, even if you bring a naivete to this whole issue, when somebody explains that to you, you say, well, if it were a dog killed in the street, or if it were some regular normal person, you know, what would it matter really, you know, in this stage? But we're talking about the president of the United States, which one has to say really does elevate the discussion to some degree anyway.
Well, one of the things that I get out of your magnificent book is, you know, we're all familiar with intrigues and complexities and the politics with regard to the internals of the Warren Commission itself. But something that you've really helped to clarify for me are the conflicts, the political distortions, the maneuvering, the contortions between the FBI, the President of the United States, the Justice Department, and the Warren Commission. So there's a much bigger controversy, really, in terms of the relationships between those four elements in particular. Justice Department, President, FBI, and the Warren Commission, everybody is at odds with each other.
Let me ask you this, Alan. Now you clearly have spent some time on Breach of Trust of the book. I ask this. This is sort of just a general question, but I'm aiming at you as a person who was pretty well found, well grounded in this historic situation. But when you were looking at Breach of Trust, and I asked this to you, but I'm thinking of a larger audience.
Absolutely.
Because one of the things that are in the book Breach of Trust that I rarely ever see, because I really don't see too many reports or book reviews of Breach of Trust. I guess I've seen a couple that were sent down by Briggs over at the University of Kansas Press. But in the book, in the hardback copy, I don't know what it is on the paperback copy, there is, at the end of it, there is in Breach of Trust, there is an Appendix A.
That's the Tickler document,
yes,
right?
Yes, the Tickler file.
Absolutely.
Well, then and the thing that's about that, what I call here, I'll just point this out, maybe your listeners will benefit from this, is that I call this it's accidental totally, because Tickler files are interior. These are FBI interior files. These are never to be, and in this particular case, somebody screwed up or somebody had a mad one that day, Anyway, this...
We got
this,
lucky. That's what happened. I think we got lucky.
We got lucky. And Mark Allen, who... And what is sort of funny about this, in a way, is that Mark Allen, when he got this tickler file, he really didn't ever try to make anything out of it. I mean, I think he... I don't know what it was with him. But if you look at this tickler file... what I call it, in large part, I just call this thing as a it is the DNA of the FBI.
Well, it's an internal document. It's 4 pages, and in those 4 pages is basically everything that we would have wanted to know about the FBI's attitude about
an explanation of why we never got to know it, in terms of what the devil was. I mean, you just check Alex Rosen, who was number 4 man, I guess. I said 3 earlier, but number 4 man, I think, in the hierarchy.
Under Belmont, right? Or under William Sullivan? I don't know. It's Tolson and then Belmont and then Sullivan?
It's on the second page, I think. And really what it is the FBI's attitude in terms of handling the case. Yeah. And what Alex Rosen says, he says the FBI's handling the case, he explains it this way, standing with pockets open waiting for evidence to drop in. That's classic.
But one of the things that it kind of reminds me to examine, and I so appreciate you raising this, because it's something that would not be something we might think of to discuss, especially if my objective with regard to this program is to make it accessible to people who are not necessarily experienced in terms of delving into the deepest aspects of the related subjects. So we want this information to be accessible to people who are not walking encyclopedias about all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that tickler document, you're right, we never hear anybody refer to it. One of the things that it sort of complements is the understanding that the FBI was receiving quite a lot of the information that they were going on, that they were working with, from the CIA, and that even though it's not explicit in that document, it sort of corroborates the idea that, as opposed to this, the greatest, you know, what was it Ford, Gerald Ford said about this Gibraltar of factual literature? Where would that be? But in the meantime, you're aware that John Witten...
Ford was Hoover's man on the commission, I mean, more than anybody else. I mean, he was just feeding it information. I mean, every opportunity he got. Yeah. And then the FBI let him have certain FBI toys, you know, when he went golfing or stuff. I don't know. But anyway,
I don't know either.
Yeah, Ford's a miserable... I mean, you know, we have an aircraft carrier now. That's going to cost us, what, $4 billion, I don't know, $12 billion, I don't know. It's going to be named the Gerald Ford Aircraft Carrier.
Yeah.
And right now it's full of problems. They can't get it. They can't get it out.
Gerald Ford's.
The water.
Gerald Ford's.
Well, anyway, I didn't know we were going there. But,
that's okay.
do you want to do anything about Oswald's 45 hours or anything?
This is exactly what I'd like to do. Allow me to take a brief intermission, Professor.
Sure.
We're speaking with Professor Gerald D. McKnight about his extraordinary and valuable book, Breach of Trust, How the Warren Commission Failed the Nation and Why. Please stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to JFK Lancer Conversations with Alan Dale. Visit us online at www.jfklancer.com. JFK Lancer, Spotlight. Enemy of the Truth, Myths, Forensics, and the Kennedy Assassination by Sherry P. Feaster.
For the great enemy of the truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, contrived and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic.
CSI Dallas.
The weather couldn't be better.
We subject all facts to a prefabricated set of interpretations.
And here comes the president now.
We enjoy the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought.
America's most important murder investigation begins a new chapter.
President Kennedy was shot from the front, and front is not the grassy knoll. Enemy of the Truth, Myths, Forensics, and the Kennedy Assassination by Sherry P. Feaster introduces a new era of scientific investigation, new research, new methods, and new understanding based upon contemporary forensic disciplines that have the authority to revise history. The most consequential murder of the 20th century remains the most controversial murder investigation in American history. After 50 years, forensic science has caught up to America's nightmare. Enemy of the Truth, Myths, Forensics, and the Kennedy Assassination. SherryFeaster.com.
We're speaking with Professor Gerald D. McKnight. His book is Breach of Trust, How the Warren Commission Failed the Nation and Why. There's a brand new 2013 edition. And Professor, you began the book, the first chapter you called Assembling the Official Truth of Dallas. Relevant to the official truth, of course, the central figure is this young man, 24-year-old Lee Harvey Oswald. Tell me about Lee Oswald's last 45 hours of life.
Okay. The first mention of Lee Harvey Oswald's name, it comes across the radio for Air Force Two. Air Force Two at that time, folks a little bit rusty on their history of this period or just simply hadn't spent time with it, is that that most of the Kennedy cabinet on the 22nd of November, and this may have something to do with the planning of this whole thing, not that the Kennedy cabinet was aware.
Correct. But, I gotcha.
But most of them were in an airplane heading for Japan.
Right.
I think it was Bobby Kennedy was not there, and there were two other cabinet members. I think one was the Postmaster General and somebody else.
And the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, was not there.
Yes, McNamara was. You're right. McNamara was not there.
But Secretary of State, all kinds of other people, Pierre Salinger, who was and they're en route to Japan.
En route to Japan, and Dean Rusk was a senior member of that group that was taking them out for a meeting. Well, what happened was is that as that plane was approaching Japan, what time it was exactly? I think it was about. Clattering across the radio, comes a report. That the president. There's been a shooting in Dallas.
Right. Three shots fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
Yes, mm-hmm. And that message came from the Situation Room, and the guy in charge of the Situation Room was at that particular time. Well, was Kennedy's assistant for national security affairs, and that was McGeorge Bundy. Now, there's a lot one could say about George Bundy in terms of his politics. Bundy, I don't know. I would just say this: is that it's questionable where Bundy's real loyalties rested. For example, Arthur Schlesinger, in A Thousand Days, on page 250, berates him for what he said was his betrayal of JFK when it came to the Bay of Pigs planning. But he's still around at this time, and he's the one who's sending this message out to Air Force. Well, I'll call it Air Force Two, because it isn't carrying the president. And so after the announcement went out that there was a shooting in Dallas and the president was involved, about 15 minutes later, Bundy comes back on again. And 15 minutes later, we find out that Lancer, with the president has been shot. He is dead, and the person who is being held now and who is suspected of being the assassin is a man by the name of Oswald, and Oswald had been to Russia.
Yes.
And we are there, and that's where the situation is. Now, what's interesting about this? I was doing research a long time ago up at University of Harvard. Harvard University, and one of the things I was looking at, I did hear that Pierre Salinger, who because of his position as JFK's press secretary, was going to get access to the original transcript of the Air Force One tapes.
Right.
Between the Air Force, that, by that I mean that's the plane now that would be carrying LBJ, Jackie mm-hmm. Kennedy, and
sure.
members of the Kennedy team from Love Field to Dallas, that Pierre Salinger had access to these tapes, and particularly phone traffic between Air Force One and then the Air Force Two that had the cabinet complement that was heading toward Japan.
Right.
Schlesinger, having access to this, did a manuscript
Salinger.
On this.
Salinger.
Salinger, yes. Who did I say?
Well, that's okay.
Anyway, it was Salinger is who I'm talking about, yes.
Right.
Incorporated some of this material in a manuscript he left with Harvard University
yeah.
and was allegedly supposed to be available. While I was up there doing work at Howard, I asked to take a look at this thing, and they told me it's missing. So that's very interesting, because one would really love to know
mm-hmm.
With Air Force One. Now this would be with Johnson on Air Force One now,
mm-hmm.
as he's now left
Dallas on the way back to Andrews Air Force Base
and back to Andrews, who he was talking to. Well, it seems clear to me that certainly one of the first people he began talking to was J. Edgar Hoover. And the reason I say that is because two FBI agents were directed to go to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and this is before Air Force One ever landed. So he had to be talking to Hoover, and not only Hoover in terms of sending or getting in touch with the Baltimore office and saying, send two FBI agents down to Bethesda Naval Hospital, because that's where the autopsy is going to take place. As you know, and people I'm sure listening here know, that this autopsy was conducted at the Naval Hospital, and it was conducted by the military. And that's sort of key, and it would be lovely to have found out, in addition, what the discussion was between LBJ and Hoover, and who else he was speaking to the way back.
Right.
Huh?
I believe Bill Kelly is doing some important work on these tapes. Bill Kelly is a JFK researcher.
Yes, I know Bill Kelly by
things.
Reputation.
And I believe mm-hmm. that, you know, I think that Pierre Salinger, with regard to his book, was called With Kennedy, at least the first one. And I believe, it's possible I'm mistaken, but I think William Manchester, Death of a President, and mm-hmm. Teddy White, who had the extraordinary...
Yes, you're right about White.
Yeah. That he mm-hmm. also may have had access to these materials, which now seem to have disappeared.
Yeah. Well, I would say here is that we go from that anyway. I mean, that's an area that one almost salivates thinking about. Boy, I'd love to have gotten a hold of those.
Well, you know, you're touching upon all kinds of things that are. I mean, we couldn't even begin to do justice just to that part of the story. The other part of the story is how a description that mm-hmm. Has hardly any resemblance whatsoever to Lee Oswald is introduced to the police investigation within 15 minutes of the shooting. And all of a sudden, we've got 5, 10, 165 pounds, and we can't even begin to deal with that, I think.
Well, that's the CIA's Lee Henry. I won't go into that, but that's Lee Henry Oswald, and that's the business that he was, 5, 10, about 165 pounds,
that's right,
30 years old, all mm-hmm. that business. There is that.
That is a good segue into what you've described as Oswald in the frame. Can you tell me what that means?
Okay. Oswald, by 12:45, Oswald's name is and by 1:40 Central Standard Time, by 1:40 Central Standard Time, Oswald is being named by the Dallas police as the shooter who killed Kennedy and wounded Governor Connally.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Oswald in the lockup. I could begin, I guess, in terms of the way this thing was handled, would be take the lineups, for example. On the 22nd, he was subjected to, I think it was either three or four lineups. In the lineups, he's the only one in the lineup wearing handcuffs. He was wearing a dirty T-shirt in which he was arrested.
Oh, and he was scuffed up. He had a black eye.
He had a mouse over his left eye.
What's wrong with this picture?
His face was scratched. most of the others in the lineup were Dallas cops wearing
yeah,
suits.
They're straight.
Now Oswald
yeah.
did complain about the unfairness
oh,
of
yeah.
these lineups, but
mm-hmm.
but to no avail.
Right.
What I did find interesting, though, Alan, is that they were part of the Warren Commission team, where these young folks, young guys, all of them graduated from the top law schools serving on the commission. Some of them on this business of the lineups were absolutely aghast at the unfairness of this, and they complained that Oswald's rights were compromised. Of course, nothing came of this as far as the commission is concerned. I don't even know if the commissioners ever heard about this, and if they did, they would have dismissed it. Oswald interrogation sessions on the 22nd. I think he was subjected to 5 separate interrogations. On Saturday, he was subjected to 3 more sessions of interrogation. And then on Sunday, he was interrogated for 1 hour before he was taken down to the basement of the police station to be transported to the county jail. The interrogation time for Oswald overall was about, I think, By the time he was at the Dallas police, was over 12 hours and 30 minutes. And that would have been 12 hours and 30 minutes on the 22nd. On the 23rd, he was subjected to, I think, another 7.5 hours. And on the last day, on Sunday, he was subjected, I think, to he was interrogated for about an hour. That's pretty significant in terms of in terms of interrogation.
These interrogations are ostensibly being conducted, or at least supervised, by Will Fritz, but the FBI
yes.
is certainly present, and there's
at least nine FBI agents were in these interrogation sessions,
yeah.
and of course the Secret Service,
right.
Kelly. Particularly. So, and you know, these, I don't know if they had rooms big enough to hold all these people.
Mm-hmm. Apparently
so,
not big enough to hold a stenographer or a record player.
No,
or a record player.
No,
yeah.
no. So there's Oswald. I mean, he's dressed in a ratty t-shirt and, mm-hmm. you know, he's got a mouse over eye scrape and the whole business. But as I say, there is one minor elevated ethical interest here is that there was some complaint from staffers like John Hart Ely, of Yale Law School graduate, magna cum laude, all that, who complained. He didn't complain now to Warren. This guy is just he's just a staffer.
No, he may
but
have
he did,
complained
he,
to J. Lee Rankin or somebody like that. Somebody that
he
was...
complained. Well, he probably complained to somebody down lower in the chain, but he wasn't the only one. So I would just simply say, you know, hooray, or good for him. So here we have this business. Here we have the business of Oswald's interrogation, and you know, I think everybody knows, if they don't, that this extraordinary lengthy period of discussing with Oswald, and you got all these, you got the Secret Service, you got the FBI in the room. Then we find out that when it came to the interrogations, there was no tape recorder. I mean, that's the thing that floors you. And so we have this situation. We have this lengthy interrogation of the man who killed the president of the United States.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. And no one thought of the question is, why was not he on tape? And then we get this story back from Fritz, particularly. I guess he had to. He was forced to say this. You know, the business's argument was, well, he had applied for the last 2 years for money to buy a tape recorder, and the city had turned him down, so he had no tape recorder. So the American people are asked to. I mean, here we are. The American people are asked to face. We're facing the greatest trauma. Certainly the most transforming political event of the 20th century, I think, in terms of the consequences of what happened in Dallas. and maybe quite possibly in the world, I would say, come think of it, you think about Vietnam, Kennedy might have ended our involvement in Vietnam, and that would have made a hell of a lot of difference in terms of what our military would be like and what the country would be like now. I'm pretty certain of that.
I agree.
So the American people are asked to accept the only official suspect in the Kennedy assassination was himself silenced, and there's no record explaining his alleged actions. Well, excuse me, what really happened? After Oswald's own assassination by Ruby on Sunday, the Secret Service moved in, swept up Marina Oswald, her two infant children, Robert Oswald, Oswald's brother, and Mrs. Oswald, Oswald's mother. And it made sense. Get them out of Dallas. My God, I mean, the son has been murdered, and who knows what kind of revenge will be taken against the family.
So they check them into a motel, right?
Yes, they go outside of Dallas. They end up at a motel in Arlington, Six Flags Motel. After dinner, they have a dinner. Everybody sits down. They have a dinner. It's lovely. After dinner, the Secret Service interrogated Marina Oswald for 8 hours. The interrogation, all of it, is on tape. This tape record was sent off immediately to Secret Service headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Right.
These tapes have never surfaced. I can give you the source here is I give you the source. It's to Director and SAC Special Agent in Charge Washington Field from SAC Dallas FBI Oswald Files 105-82555-412 and 105-82555-0412B1. The reason I say that is because I've never seen this before. I think I'm the first to drag this up. I'm not sure, but I think so. Any event, that's the situation.
We have this kind of interesting irony that the FBI was sufficiently concerned about the value of whatever Marina Oswald would have to say through her translator or whatever, but there's no similar concern about the value of whatever the accused would have to say, so that no one bothers to record that. That's odd, isn't it?
Well, odd is a very kind way of putting it. Let's say let's just we'll go with that. We'll say it is odd.
It's odd, isn't it? One of many oddities, no shortage.
Yes. The question is, what happened?
Yeah.
What happened to that 8 hours of tape? And I guess we're talking about one of the two things that happened: that the tape is being held somewhere. It could still be government property being held somewhere, or it's down the memory hole.
Or it could have been in James Angleton's safe, like all kinds of other strange things. I'm curious about your – I know we're running short on time, and I don't want to abuse this privilege of being allowed to speak with you. There are a couple of quick things I want to touch upon. One is, Senator Arlen Specter, obviously he was just a junior counsel. He was really – my perception of the position that he was in, and correct me if you think otherwise, but I honestly feel sort of slightly sympathetic towards him, at least to a limited extent. I feel that he was in a very, very difficult scenario, and that if he hadn't complied with what the specifications as were represented by all of the forces at work to define an official version come hell or high water, I'm talking specifically about the shooting sequence, surely they would simply have replaced him with someone further down the line who would do whatever was necessary. Do you feel that maybe he's in a difficult situation and we should sort of shrug?
Well, I think it was clear that where this thing was going, that is what – the writing was clearly on the wall, I think in terms of Arlen Specter, I mean, nobody could ever say Arlen Specter didn't have ambition. I mean, he shifted from Republican to Democrat.
That's right.
All of that. And I was planning on doing a chapter. I don't know if it'll work out or not. I was doing a chapter on both he and Ford, who I regard as two of the most disagreeable sons of bitches on the among those on the commission, because they did things that they knew were, Jerry Ford, of course, was nothing more than a stooge for Hoover on the commission. And Specter was thinking, I'm sure he was thinking about what? He's thinking about his political future.
Yeah. And he's disposable.
Remember the guy who was the attorney? There was a guy on the commission early on. He left in March. Mm-hmm. He was a New Yorker, and oh God, I can't remember. He had a top position in New York. He was on the commission. He could smell what way this thing was going. And in March, he gave an argument that he had to go back to his law firm, and he left. I cannot think of his name.
Yeah.
It doesn't come to me. But he got out. But of course, he got out. He had already been a top lawman in the government in New York, and so he would have no problem in terms of mobility. That sort of thing. And what happened in September of 1964, September the 23rd, 1964. As a result of a request by a guy by the name of Mel Stewart, who was the executive vice president for Walper Productions Incorporated, I never did see this film. It was called 4 Days in November. You may have seen
it.
Okay.
I think it's possible that this is the one that was narrated by Gregory Peck, who had won the Academy Award for To Kill a Mockingbird.
A lot of money went into it. And they expected to get this out in October, which would have been almost maybe 3 weeks or maybe a month after the Warren Commission report came out. I don't know when the 26 volumes came out. They didn't come out. I don't think they were simultaneous.
No, they were not.
But anyway. So 4 days, it was called 4 Days in November. Well, anyway, Mel Stewart, the executive VP, got in touch with Rankin, and he said, "You think you could convince Hoover, FBI Director Hoover, to have the FBI look at our transcript for the program to alert us if we made any serious errors in it?
Right.
Double check it." Mm-hmm. And the Hoover, I'm sure, probably grouched about this and that. But when Rankin got to him, this is all PR stuff anyway. So Hoover said, okay. So they took a look at the transcript. Well, one of the things I found very interesting, and I think this probably I've never seen this before either. I don't know if I've seen it before. That's why I'm saying it here, because I thought it would be interesting.
Yeah.
Is that when they looked at the transcript, the one who looked at it was Augie Belmont. He really is the guy who ran the investigation, because Hoover was, taking naps in the afternoon, and Tolson had already had a stroke and was recovering from that, if in fact he ever did. I'm not sure whether he ever did. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so this is inside. This is totally insider stuff. This is not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy never believed in the freedom of information or that situation. They looked at it. So there's commentary. But one of the things that the most interesting strikes me here is that this was key here. The FBI, and particularly the chief guy who worked on this kind of scientific evidence about guns and shooting and that sort of thing, a guy named Gallagher. Gallagher is not called before the Warren Commission until the very end. It is in September of 64.
Wow.
He is the last one to present himself. And he's in a one-on-one with Redlich, who was a good man on the commission. And in that exchange, there is nothing said about the rifle and the weapons, the alleged rifle and the ammunition that was used in the killing. There is nothing said about that, and that's despite the fact that an examination had been done on this stuff.
Right.
So Gallagher comes on, he spends some time with Redlich, and they just pat each other on the back, and they talk about inconsequential stuff. And then that's it. They close it down. Well, anyway, Belmont, this is now all, of course, all QT. This is now all stuff that's not anything, but it's not going to go public.
Yeah.
They look at the movie script, and in the movie script, it says that the paraffin tests carried out by the FBI link Oswald with the assassination weapon.
Yeah.
Belmont responds to this way. He said, quote, "This is erroneous, as the tests were essentially negative." He then goes on to say, quote, "In addition, highly mechanical examinations made by the Atomic Energy Commission and our laboratory showed the paraffin tests could not connect Oswald with the rifle."
Period.
Case closed.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Case closed.
Wow,
pull up
wild.
The flag or bring it down, one or the other. Set sail or do something.
That's amazing.
You know,
Professor, I want to correct something that I said a moment ago. I happen to have a means by which I can look this up. I was correct in remembering that Gregory Peck did indeed narrate something from the same period as 4 Days in November. But the film that 4 Days in November was actually nominated for an Academy Award, I believe, in 1965.
Was it really?
Gregory Peck was not associated with that. He was the off-screen narrator of a film called Years of Lightning, Day of Drums. And so
okay.
I wanted to make certain
sure.
Yes, I remember the Years of Lightning, Day of Drums. I'm not absolutely certain that I've ever seen 4 Days in November. I usually, when I have an opportunity such as this, I always like to ask a very simple two-part question. The first is, how did you learn... how did you learn about these terrible consequential events? Where were you when you got the news? And the second question the second part is, when did you first realize that there was reason to question what your government was telling you?
Good questions, because they bring in biography. And we were all, whether we knew it or not, or whether we cared or not, we were all impacted by November 22nd, 63. I was doing a master's degree at Penn State. And I was on my way from where I was living up there with my mother. There were just two of us. I was on my way to class when I passed probably one of the bigger department stores in College Park. And there were a lot of people standing outside this window, which was their television window, you know, where they had television. Like, and they were all, I mean, we're talking about three, four people deep. I thought, what in the hell are they giving away here?
Right. Yeah, right.
And so I stopped, and all of a sudden, boom. I thought, holy hell. I mean, I wasn't even thinking about Kennedy in Dallas or anything. I mean, I did have, look, I had been in Korea. I had been in Graves registration.
Late 51, 52.
That was for an 18, was it 18 and 19? I don't know what the hell I was at that time, but the Graves registration in 50, late 51, 52, the nature of that war over there was largely, masses of Chinese troops who were confronted by smaller numbers than Americans, and so there were a lot of dead bodies, a lot of casualties. A lot of these young Chinese troops went into battle without arms. They were waiting for somebody in front of them to get shot. I mean, that's how bad it was.
Wow.
So I was over there. I didn't want to be over there, but there I was. I mean, the thing that saved my ass, I think, is the fact the guys in my outfit were, a lot of the guys in my outfit were guys who were late 20s, early 30s. They were World War II Marine veterans.
Uh-huh.
They'd seen it all. Man, they had seen it all.
Mm-hmm.
So here they are finishing up their tour, 20-year vets, you know, that kind of thing. And when you get young guy like me, you know, they sort of looked after me, took care of me, and since they had all this time, they weren't going to be bullshitted by any second lieutenant, who was 25 years old. And just so there was that. There was that. But just to see that and just to be part of something like that. So I wasn't a naive young person. I mean, I'd seen that. And so anyway, so there it was. I mean, there was the Kennedy business. And I didn't even know how I felt about Kennedy at that time. I can't remember. But I do remember, boy, I do remember that. And then I do remember going to class. And the teacher, I can't remember her name. Lovely woman who was teaching a Renaissance Reformation course. And probably in her own life had never stepped out beyond Renaissance Reformation, that time period. You know, I mean, and so I can't remember her name, but I remember being in class. I remember somebody opening the door. Now, this is after I had known about the Kennedy, about Dallas. And somebody opened the door and said, Mrs. whatever, Dr. somebody, whatever it is, President Kennedy has been shot and was killed in Dallas. And she looked up from her lecture notes. I'll never forget this. This was astonishing. Thank you, hon. This was astonishing. She looked up from her lecture notes, and she smiled sweetly at this person. And she said, thank you. And then she went right on.
Oh, my God. That never right on like teaching. That before. Wow.
Right on teaching. Oh so my. Anyway, so that there we were with that. And then the next thing was just simply – it was just simply a stroke of what I would call it good luck. Later, after I got my master's at Penn State, I ended up in the PhD program here at Maryland, and graduated with a PhD sometime in the 70s. I can't remember when it was, and was looking for work. Went up to Maine. It was a position up there, University of Maine. I went up, I interviewed for it. It looked was fairly favorable. I went home again. I thought, I got home back to, we were living down in College Park. And I thought to myself, Jesus Christ, Maine, what am I going to do in Maine? Write the history of the potato again or something? I didn't know what the hell I would do up there. So I didn't take the job. I ended up teaching part-time at the University of Maryland. I did teach a year at Howard, and then I taught a year. I was teaching a night school, or whatever they called it then, at University of Maryland. And then ultimately, looking for work, and I finally got a job. I got a full-time job half-time job at the college here, Hood College.
And is that how you encountered?
That's how that's all had not. It was, you know, it were the two ways. I mean, just total dumbass luck, number one. Or second of all, somebody up there is rolling the dice up in the heavens up there. And they said, oh, let's get this character. Let's do something for him or put him in a position where he may be able to do something.
Yeah.
So the thing about it was two things. First of all, I then would move up here to Frederick. And unbeknownst to me, I ended up living 3 minutes away from Harold Weisberg.
Isn't that something?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Which had its pluses and it had some minuses. Someday I'll sit down and tell you about that.
We need to do a separate show just on that, really, honestly.
Oh, yeah. Well, I owe Harold a hell of a lot. I mean,
he was an
impossible son of a bitch.
Sure.
But on the other hand, he was remarkable, and he just threw his
full being.
Cellar, which is where he had, that's, yes, his 58 file cabinets, whatever the hell it was, down the basement.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the other thing I have to say, too, is because this was another one of these unplanned for, and my own self, I mean, I had no idea. The woman who was the chairman of the department at History Poli Sci, a woman by the name of Virginia Lewis, the strange creature. I mean, she was about 6'3". Built like, I don't know, a misshapen army tent. I mean, there was nothing about her that was
attractive.
The
Secret Service follow-up car, right? They call the Queen Mary?
But she was a Kennedy person, and she knew Kennedy.
Wow.
Okay? Now, he was in the Senate then, I think. And when I got to know Harold, and I'd get over there and we'd talk and all that sort of thing, I thought, and I saw that basement of his with the file cabinets and with the open door policy. I thought, holy hell. I said to Virginia, I said, how about if we get a course started on the Kennedy assassination? She said, beautiful.
Wow.
You set it up? Now, you got to understand, I don't have to tell you this. You have to understand. Now, had I been teaching at University of Maryland or University of Virginia
or
somebody
anywhere else, yeah.
Anywhere else. And the chair of the history department called me in, said, well, McKnight, you've been here for a year. Your teaching seems to be okay. Students seem to like you. Seem to be getting along. What are your professional plans? Well, I said to him, my professional plans, sir, are just to move ahead and do some research on the Kennedy assassination and maybe get a book out of this. You know what they would said to me?
Goodbye.
They would have said yes, either goodbye or, oh, really? I think maybe we ought to set aside some time and discuss this in terms of your, you know, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And there it is. And there it is.
It's a great story.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that I didn't even think about it, but what I think about it sometimes here is that, you know, if you do some decent work, but what is important, I think, to the fraternity of people who are working, and I could call it that, or this convocation of people, whatever you want to call it, that sometimes if you get somebody who's writing on the subject and they have a PhD in history or something, it helps, I think, add. And I just simply say that because I think it's important. It helps to add, I think, a little bit of legitimacy to the whole process. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I think that as long as you don't become offensive, like what the hell is that guy? I was trying to think of that guy's name.
We don't have to name names. We both could, I can assure you of that. But, anyway. I mean, that's what we touched upon the other day in a conversation about this sort of extraordinary internecine conflict among people
mm-hmm.
who ostensibly mm-hmm. share in common that they do not accept and do not believe the official version of these stories, this terrible story.
Max Holland, you believe
But really, there's very little else that we share in common. It's really time for us to end, and I'm reluctant to do so because I'm so grateful to you for this opportunity.
Well, Alan, you'll have to come out here some evening.
Yeah.
And, when you get some time, give me a call.
I'm available later this tonight. I'm available later this afternoon. Is it, before we conclude, let me just ask you this one mm-hmm. very brief thing. You know,
sure.
you're a real veteran of this story.
Mm-hmm.
Are you optimistic about where we are at this point, fully 50 years after the fact now? Do you believe that there will be some kind of resolution?
I hadn't thought about it too much, but I think there's inertia here. I think there is. I just... You know, well, of course, somebody like I'm 81. I don't, you know, how much I don't know how much my time.
But you don't sound a day over 80, and I mean that sincerely.
Well, I shall treasure that. Yes, maybe you could send me a little card.
Not
a day over 80.
That's
right. And these other guys. I mean, these other guys are not the spring chickens either. I mean, like Dave Rohn, who I know very well. I mean, mm-hmm. he's 80. He's my age.
Yeah.
He's also a Weisberg student.
Absolutely. I'd like to thank you so much for spending this time with us. It
My
was
pleasure.
Helpful. It was informative to me. I think your book is one of the essential materials, Breach of Trust, How the Warren Commission Failed the Nation and Why. Thank you for being with us.
You've been listening to Conversations, a JFK Lancer production. Good evening.